last Sunday morning, we stopped at verse 8 because it's what's called the Song of the Sword. And I'll talk about it a little bit more in just a moment. Let's start with verse 1 of chapter 21 and get the background. I read this, but let's read it again. And the word of Jehovah came unto me, saying, Son of man, set thy face toward Jerusalem, drop thy word toward the sanctuaries, and prophesy against the land of Israel. I know that this prophecy now is going to be against Jerusalem and the land, and of course that means the people of both, but this is included, this is what he's talking about. Jerusalem and the land, that means the people within. And say to the land of Israel, thus said Jehovah, Behold, I'm against thee, and will draw forth my sword out of its sheath, and will cut off from thee the righteous and the wicked. That doesn't contradict the 18th chapter where God concerns each individual, but it simply means there's going to be a complete destruction of the land and of the city, for all will be cast out. There were a few poor ones that God left there, but very few. Seeing then that I will cut off from thee the righteous and the wicked, that is from Jerusalem and the land, therefore shall my sword go forth out of its sheath against all flesh, from the south to the north. And all flesh shall know that I, Jehovah, have drawn forth my sword out of its sheath. It shall not return any more. That is, from time to time God has threatened the land, but then withdrew the threat and did not destroy it. For this time there will be no withdrawal of the sword. This time is coming, and is coming in all of the vengeance of God's judicial and righteous wrath going to fall upon it. Sigh therefore, thou son of man, with the breaking of thy loins, and with bitterness shalt thou sigh before thy eyes. And it shall be when they say unto thee, Wherefore sighest thou? But thou shalt say, Because of the tidings, for it cometh. And every heart shall melt, and all hands shall be made feeble, and every spirit shall be faint, and all knees shall be weak as water. Behold, it cometh, and it shall be done, saith the Lord Jehovah. Right now, there's the announcement of what was going to befall the land of Israel and the city of Jerusalem. And that God was going to cut off the righteous and the wicked. They're all going to be cut off. Well, that may happen in this land or any other land. The one thing we can be assured of, that even if we are cut off, the righteous are cut off in a judgment, that we have something they don't have. We have the assurance that God is concerned with us, and we'll have a better land to which we're going. I don't want to see that destruction come, and you don't. But if it comes, what I'm trying to do in my study and preaching and teaching the last few years is to prepare people for such a judgment, which I feel is utterly inevitable. That is bound to come, it's bound to fall. A nation can't reject God, as our nation has in the last 25 or 50 years, taking his name in vain on every side, indifferent to moral issues, dishonesty in all realms of politics and government and society and economy and all of it, and go on very long. A judgment is inevitable, right? So now then, if we're cut off with the wicked, so what? If our faith is in God and our heart is fixed in heaven, we're looking for something better. This land, this world is not my home. I'm just passing through, says the song. That's right. I am a sojourner and a pilgrim, and an alien to the world, and simply passing through it on my journey to the New Jerusalem. This is a thought I want us to keep in mind all the time. Don't ever lose sight of it. This past week, I got to thinking about the condition in the country and the world today, and in the church today. And the most thing, I got to thinking about, oh, man, I said, well, what are you worried about that for? God's still in control. God is still on his throne. God still determines all these things. So why become depressed over it? I caught myself being a little depressed. I try never to be that. But once in a while, I get a little kind of overcome, as it did me. And so when I realized that and got my mind back where it belonged, why, then I went right on. But now let's come on back. Now verse 8. Now this was called the Song of the Sword. It's one of the most difficult passages in Ezekiel to translate, that the translators say. And you can tell that, well, look at all the little footnotes you have, all the little marginal readings that you have, if you have the American Standard. So when you see so many marginal readings, you'll know the passage is very difficult to translate. And so it seems to me that maybe that there's a purpose in that. Maybe Ezekiel was speaking in such a frenzied way, such an earnest way, and all that it wasn't written down as intelligible. Because what was happening sometimes, as we pointed out last Sunday from the book of Romans, there are groanings that we kind of utter, and the Holy Spirit helps us in that. So here were groanings on his part. Of what was coming here, that as he expresses it in these words, they're difficult for us to grasp and understand. But it was difficult for the people to grasp and understand what was coming upon their land. I think we have a hard time understanding it too. I'm looking, first of all, for an economic collapse. We wake up some morning and our savings that we were expecting to live on in latter days will probably be wiped out. That may come first. That will throw the nation then into anarchy, because people are going to fight for a loaf of bread and all that. So we can have a pretty rough time ahead of us. And so let's get ready for it. So now comes the Song of the Sword. And the word of Jehovah came unto me, saying, Son of man, prophesy and say, Thus saith Jehovah, say, A sword, it is sharpened and also furbished. It is sharpened that it may make a slaughter. It is furbished that it may be as lightning. Now to furbish it was to polish it. Here you sharpen it, polish it. Now apparently what Ezekiel is trying to present is this thing here, as if you were in Jerusalem and you were looking out across just a thing that mound attached up there, and you can actually in the distance see them sharpening the sword. You can see them polishing it. The sharpness is in order for slaughter, and the brightness is as it flashes and comes down. It's like lightning. It's flashing as lightning out there. So this is the picture now that Ezekiel is drawing. He wants the people to see a terrible picture. You can imagine if you're in a city and here are these folks out here, and here you see them getting their big guns ready and all that, bombing us. I can imagine the terror that took place in Arabia over there when those bombs were falling every night and all of that. Surely the people were terrified. Where will it come tonight? Where will it land tonight and all that? Well, that same terror may characterize us someday. And it goes on. Shall we then make mirth? Shall we just make light of all of this that I'm saying to you? Shall the people of Jerusalem make light of what's happening? Jeremiah was preaching over there. The rod of my son, this is hard to understand. The rod of my son is condemneth every tree. Now the alternate reading is, it condemneth the rod of my son as every tree. Or as the Revised Standard Version translates it, you have despised the rod, my son, with everything of wood. The rod was a chastening rod. So I like that translation, the Revised, everything of wood. That is, God has used a rod of wood. Now he's going to use a rod of steel, going to use the sword in order to do this. But remember that Jesus rules the nation with a rod of iron. It's not just a paddle that he uses, but a rod of iron with which he rules the nations. That's found in Psalm 2 and also in Revelation 12 and 5 and over in the 19th chapter of Revelation 15 and 16. A number of times there, he rules the nations with a rod of iron. That it may be handled, the sword, it is sharpened, yea, it is furbished, to give it into the hand of the slayer. Now, they're furbishing it, polishing the sword, getting ready, for God's going to put it into the hand of the slayer. Who is this slayer going to be? He tells them in just a few passages, verses on down, who it's going to be. Going to be Nebuchadnezzar, going to be the king of Babylon. That's one, but let's leave that till we get to it. And he goes on to say, cry and wail, son of man, for it is upon my people, it is upon all the princes of Israel. They are delivered over to the sword with my people. Smite therefore from thy thigh. So now then, this is not upon fallen nations. This that I'm talking about is upon my people, upon the prince. Now a prince, to those people, were not the son of a king, but any noble or nobleman or ruler. They spoke of all of these as princes, those that were assisted in the rule there. So now then, the sword is being furbished, being sharpened, that as lightning, it may flashing in the sun, it may fall upon my people, upon the princes there. Terrible picture. And so, and he tells them to wail here, to shriek, as it were. So I think that Ezekiel, as he's been acting out so many of these things all along, is now going to act this out as well, as he shrieks and maybe brandishes a sword, I don't know about that, but he's trying to impress upon them the terror of this picture. People read it and say, well, that can't be God. God couldn't do a thing like that. People that don't know God. His wrath is always a righteous expression of a righteous indignation. It is a judicial wrath. A wrath made necessary by the wickedness of people. It never happens to his wrath is never against the righteous or the faithful, but against the wicked. Smite therefore from thy thigh. For there is a trial, and what if even a rod that condemneth shall be no more, saith the Lord, suppose, that it be no more. Well, if it's no more, then what happened? He used to the extent of destroying the people and casting them out. So it comes to an end, that does. Now therefore, son of man, prophesy. Smite thy hands together, and let the sword be doubled the third time, that is, twice, two or three times, yea, thrice. The third time, the sword of the deadly wounded. Now, this idea of smiting the hands in the Orient, when you call it, you clap your hands, which the servant king, if you didn't have maybe not a bell, you clap the hands. You've seen it in the movies there, where the sheik or whatever would clap his hands, and here the servants would come. What? Now, smite, clap your hands, because, and God said, I'm going to clap mine. That's going to call my servant to execute this judgment against my people. And so, clap your hands in this, twice, yea, thrice, it says here. It is the sword of the great one that is deadly wounded, which entereth into their chambers. Now, I don't know for sure to understand that. What he's talking about, Nebuchadnezzar, the sword that he's going to bring, is also a deadly wounded one because he's going to destroy him, or whether he's talking about the great ones of Jerusalem, that the sword's going to destroy them. The language is a little uncertain, a little difficult there. But at any rate, we get the point that here then is the sword that's going to complete or execute one who's already deadly wounded, or it means that a deadly wounded one that will ultimately be destroyed himself will execute it. Either way, you take it there, I think it's correct. But not that it only means one of them. I have set the threatening sword, or the flashing sword here, against the glittering, it is the glittering sword against all their gates, that their heart may melt and their stumbling be multiplied. Right? Now here God said, I'm going to set them all against their gates, and here the sword is unsheathed, flashes in the sun, and now then as terror strikes the people within. Now the Jews had never believed that God would allow that city to be destroyed, for that was the city of God. But I want to point out my lesson from Romans this morning. One of the great failures of the Jews was that they always thought because God had chosen them as his special people, therefore, the temple, and that's why some people say, well, that couldn't be God. God doesn't it. No, God does. Wickedness and sin demands punishment. It necessitates punishment. Otherwise, God would be a non-moral being. He would be one that indifferent to what's right or wrong. God is not that way. All right, so that's called the Song of the Sword. And it's a terrible picture, and it's difficult to grasp it. We do get the picture. We get the picture of soldiers out here, an army surrounding the city, sharpening the sword on the grindstone, polishing it there, flashing it in the sun here, you see. And now then, the people within, terrified of what's coming on, what's about to happen. And then, the blow finally falls. But God said, this time I'm not going to put my sword back in the sheath. I'm going to execute my judgment to the full. Well, all right. Now then, in the next one here, now he tells us, verse 18, who the executor is here. All right? The word of Jehovah came unto me again, saying, also thou son of man, appoint thee two ways, that the sword of the king of Babylon may come. They twain shall come forth out of one hand, land, and mark out a place, mark it out at the head of the way to the city. Right? Now here's the thought here is this. So there the king of Babylon is the one here who's going to come. Right? Now come on down here and remember my little diagram here. All right. Right here, about here was an Ammonite. Now here was a way up here. I don't know if we put it in question mark. We come there. And down here is Rabbah, the capital of the Ammonites. Down here was Jerusalem, the capital of the Jews. Right? Now here comes the king, coming from Babylon. He comes down here and he pauses here. Now here's where he's going to make a decision. Shall I go this way and take Rabbah? Or shall I pass over this way, come on down and take Jerusalem? And this is the question that's before him. And I get the picture now. Notice what he does. So here, the king of Babylon may come, but out here two ways he can take it. Mark out a place, mark it out at the head of the way to the city. Thou shalt appoint a way for the sword to come to Rabbah, that's the capital of Ammon, by the children of Ammon, and to Judah in Jerusalem to fortify. Right? Now here he will come one of two ways. Now which will he take? Here's the description of the king making a decision. For the king of Babylon stood at the parting of the way, at the head of the two ways, to use divination. Right, so here he stands here, while the road divides here. The road here comes to here. The road divides. One comes down here to Rabbah. The other comes over here this way. Now which one shall I take? This one will be easy to take, but shall I go ahead and take it? Or shall I go on down and take the more difficult one, which will cover more territory? Now, he uses three methods of trying to decide. Now, first, notice, two ways to use divination. He shook the arrows to and fro. In other words, took two arrows, shook them two. On one of them, he would mark Jerusalem. On the other, he would mark Ammon. Right? Now, when he draws out one of them, or less than one of them, now, the third was, and he consulted the teraphim. He looked in the liver. Now the Babylonians, one of the methods that they had of determining things, kill a sheep and take the liver and drop the liver out. And the way that liver fell and certain things in it told them what to do. Now, I don't know how that would happen, but that was it. So he used these three things. Here he shook the arrows and selected one of the arrows. He then consulted the teraphim. Then he consulted the liver of a sheep here, and decided on Jerusalem. Of course, Jerusalem, I'm sure, was wishing that he'd go the other direction. But now he's coming down there, and that will be the one to attack. Right? So Ezekiel is telling him now what's going to take place here. But he's not speaking from an arrow, nor a liver, nor a teraphim. He's speaking from God. God's telling him what's going to happen here. Right? In his right hand was the divination for Jerusalem, to set battering rams to open the mouth in the slaughter, to lift up the voice with shouting, to set battering rams against the gates, to cast up mounds, to build forts. All right, so the hour that he took out with Jerusalem, or I guess some way the others told him the same thing, I don't know. We know it was all of God anyway, hour or no hour. God was directing him. At any rate, now the decision then is to take Jerusalem, set up mounds, battering rams, and take that city. Now, a battering ram was a thing that they're heavy, something like a small telephone pole, I guess, with a head on there of steel that their soldier would take to batter down the door. Sometimes they would build a shed over that, heavy shed over with 4 to 6 wheels here, and the men would get under this as they come up and did this, so that the arrow shot from above a rock thrown down wouldn't stop them, you see. That was a battering ram. It was made like that sometimes. At any rate, here's the implements of war here, and they set them all against Jerusalem. Verse 23, and it shall be unto them as a false divination in their sight. That is, who have sworn oaths unto them, but he bringeth iniquity to remembrance, that they may be taken. Now, Zedekiah had sworn with an oath by Jehovah that he would be faithful unto Nebuchadnezzar. All is in the hand of God. God is in control there. Now, this is a lesson that we need to learn, that irrespective of divination, whether it was Nebuchadnezzar or in the city of Jerusalem, trying to figure out how to escape the judgment, but God has unsheathed the sword. Nebuchadnezzar is his sword. He's going to bring the thing to an end, though. They're going to destroy the city and bring the nation to an end as a kingdom, or it could be permanent. All right? And so this is the point there. So now then, here's the song of the sword for the benefit of the Jews. That God's going to destroy that city there, that they may know that God is doing it. Now here he's going to use Babylon. So he's telling them that they may understand that God is going to use Babylon as an instrument of his judgment. Now then, the next one here is, as you move on, now in a judgment against Zedekiah, the prince of Judah. Therefore thus saith the Lord Jehovah, because you have made your iniquity to be remembered, in that your transgressions are uncovered, so that in all your doings your sins do appear, because that you are come to remembrance, you shall be taken with the hand. Now that's addressed now to the princes, and especially to Zedekiah, who had sworn with an oath by Jehovah he will be loyal to Nebuchadnezzar. Now then, you have betrayed that. You've not done that. You're lined up with Ammonites and others here against him. You get that in other portion of scriptures. Now then, God says, your iniquity is going to be brought to light. Now notice this next one is not only a prophecy of the end of Zedekiah, but it's also a messianic prophecy. I want you to note this one carefully. Verse 25. And thou, O deadly, wounded, wicked one, the prince of Israel. That's the king of Zedekiah. Now remember, class, that Zedekiah was set up by Nebuchadnezzar in 597 when he carried away Jehoiakim, Konah, who was the king at that time. So actually, Zedekiah was in reality a puppet king of Nebuchadnezzar. So I don't know, one man said that Ezekiel never called him a king. I'm not sure, I didn't check that carefully. So I don't know. But generally he speaks of him as the prince. He really doesn't honor him with the word, the title king. But I didn't check that carefully enough that I like to when I read something like that. But the prince of Israel, whose day is come, in the time of the iniquity of the end, thus saith the Lord Jehovah, remove the mitre and take off the crown. There shall be no more the same. Exalt that which is low, and abase that which is high. Now read that carefully. Now notice what it says, remove the mitre. Now the mitre was a turban worn by the high priest. Now whether he had assumed the responsibility of the high priest, I don't think he has no record of that. Probably he wore some kind of a turban that we don't know anything about. But at any rate, remove the mitre and take off the crown. This is no more going to be as it was. Now you're going to have this statement that I think is a very important statement, and associated one with Jeremiah, that points out that with the end of Konah, there will never be another king sitting on the throne of Judah and ruling in Jerusalem that would prosper. And there never was, never has been, never will be. That the old kingdom is come to an end. That's all over. Well, I want to get to that in a minute. And I look a little further. Remove the mitre, take off the crown. There shall be no more the same. Exalt that which is low and abase that which is high. I will overturn it. Now that's for emphasis. The three overturn there is for emphasis, that God is going to overturn the thing and it will never again be the same. And it never was and never will be. There's never been another king on the throne of Judah by divine appointment or in harmony with God, who never has been, and there never will be. That's changed. Now notice the next verse. There's a very important one. This also shall be no more, until he come, whose right it is, and I will give it him. Right? Now, when God brings brought Coronai to an end, that was the last one that sat on the throne of Judah, imposter, or that sat on the throne of Judah, rather, by divine appointment. Zedekiah was put up there by Nebuchadnezzar's appointment. And now then, under he whose right it is, who is to come. Now, who was that? Of course, that was the Messiah. And such as Genesis 49 and verses 9 and 10, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, when Messiah will come, and unto him shall the obedience of the people be. In other words, the lineage from Judah through David was never lost sight of. Even when Judah always had a descendant of David on the throne, except Athaliah. Athaliah, the daughter of Jezebel and Ahaz, who ruled for 6 years, was a usurper. She was never recognized as a ruler, a king, as a queen that ruled. She was a usurper. So there was always one of David's seed on the throne, except for those 6 years of her usurpation. But with the end of it, there would not be another one until the Messiah should come. So here's what we have then. Here from David now, here Coronai and Zedekiah. Right? Coronai, the last one by divine appointment, Zedekiah, a prophet, a man now of the coming of Jesus Christ. Excuse me. There was not another king on the throne of Judah. Now, one of the Maccabees wanted to set himself up as a king, but he failed. Right, now, let me go back to Jeremiah. There are two passages going to have associated together. Turn to Jeremiah, the 22nd chapter. And here, beginning with verse 24, I'll read all of it. As I live, saith Jehovah, though Coronai, the son of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, with a signet upon the right hand, yet would I pluck thee thence. Right? Now with Coronai, who was carried away at 597 when Ezekiel was, then Zedekiah was set up as a puppet king by Nebuchadnezzar. Now come over here to verse 29. O earth, earth, earth. That's the emphasis again. Hear the word of Jehovah. Thus saith Jehovah, write ye this man childless, right, Coronai, a man that shall not prosper in his days, for no more shall a man of his seed prosper sitting upon the throne of David and ruling in Judah. Now when he said mark him childless, that is, so far as the throne was concerned, we had children all right, for Jesus came through the lineage of Coronai, but he was but he had not mark him childless so far as the throne was concerned. Now no more shall one of his seed, Coronai's seed, the lineage of the Davidic kingdom there, sit upon the throne of David, ruling in Jerusalem and prosper. Right? Now, how does that affect the millennial position? That Jesus is coming back, set up a throne in Jerusalem, and rule there for 1,000 years. That will flatly contradict what Jeremiah said. Jeremiah said, no more shall one of David's descendants, through Coronai, sit upon the throne of David, ruling in Jerusalem and prosper. So Jesus, two reasons why Christ couldn't do it. One is, he couldn't do it and prosper, because God said he couldn't. Another is, he couldn't be a priest and a king both. The priestly lineage is completely lost sight of. The Aaronic priesthood is there. But at any rate, so he couldn't sit and rule on a throne and prosper in Judah. And besides, in Jerusalem, if the old is established, you couldn't have a king and a priest in one person. That's what I'm trying to say. Two reasons why Jesus can never come back and rule in Judah. Yet millennialists are preaching in all of the country that this, we're getting toward the end, Christ will come back, set up his throne, and rule after 1,000 years. Can't do it without violating all the principles of Scripture. And I put that passage together. Now that's what he says here about Coronai and Zedekiah. Really, he was not a son of Coronai. He was a half brother or nephew. I forget which, half brother or half nephew. And now dropping back over here, he said, "Take the Lord to remove the mitre, take off the crown. This shall be no more the same. Exalt that which is low, and abase that which is high. I will overturn it. This also shall be no more until he come whose right it is, and I will give it him. Well, now then, the kingship and the priesthood, with the temple and all that, well, no, the priesthood was established later. But the king would not never be established again with the death of Coronah and Zedekiah. You ought to have those two passages marked in your Bible. 22nd chapter of Jeremiah, the last verse of 29, 30 along there, the last two or three verses. And this one, the 21st chapter of Ezekiel, 25 through 27. You have those two marked. Study them, understand what they're saying. Then you can readily see that God said the whole thing as a political kingdom would come to an end with the death of captivity of Coronah and the death of Zedekiah. That brought the kingdom to an end. It never was a political kingdom. Oh, I'll take that back. Say it differently. It never was the kingdom that was destroyed. It never was again established. When they came back, it was a petty kingdom, but they never had another king on the tribe of David. And you couldn't have and the old can't be restored until, and they keep talking about even the Jews here going back and reestablishing the old kingdom. Now, they can't do that without a king of the tribe of David and a priest of the tribe of Levi. And there's not a Jew on earth that can tell you of what tribe he descended. That was destroyed with Jerusalem when the chronologies of all those were all destroyed with the destruction of Jerusalem. So no Jew today knows the tribe he descended from. So you can never have a kingdom. The Jews talking about establishing a kingdom, the old Judaistic kingdom, can never be destroyed without a king of the tribe of David, family of David, and a priest of the tribe of Levi. So that's gone forever. Christ is not coming back because he couldn't sit on a throne and prosper ruling in Jerusalem. And so there'll neither be another political kingdom like the one destroyed, nor will there be a messianic kingdom established in Jerusalem. All right, any question on that? Okay, I move on. Now comes a prophecy against Ammon. And thou, son of man, prophesy and say, thus saith the Lord Jehovah concerning the children of Ammon, and concerning their reproach. And say thou, whatever that reproach was, you can find it, if you had time to go look for it. And say thou, a sword is drawn for the slaughter. It is for the slaughter it is furbished, to cause it to devour, that it may be as lightning, while they see for thee false visions, while they divine lies unto thee, to lay thee upon the necks of the wicked that are deadly wounded, whose day is come in the time of iniquity of the end. All right, now here you have three nations. Over here is Babylon over here. God's going to use Babylon. Here are the Ammonites. God's going to bring a sword against the Ammonites. He's going to bring that sword down against Jerusalem, against the Jews. All right, here are three nations that Ezekiel brings into the picture that describe God's rule in these nations here and his use of them. The determination of the destiny of it. Now let's look a little further. While they see for the false divination, they will have false vision divinations, all right, about what's going to happen. But this is what's going to happen. All of those will come to naught. All their false divinations. Whose day is come. Now cause it to return into its sheath. In the place where thou wast created. Now I think he's turning now to Nebuchadnezzar. I think this is Nebuchadnezzar, who is the sword. And going to hit the sword against Ammon and against Jerusalem. Now you put it in your sheath now, and I'll bring you back to the land where you were created. In the land of thy birth will I judge thee, and I will pour out mine indignation upon thee. I will blow upon thee with the fire of my wrath, and I will deliver thee into the hand of brutish men, skillful to destroy. Now I think that prophecy there is against Nebuchadnezzar. And he couldn't say that outright because he's in Babylon, and I don't know how, to what extent those Babylonians examined the literature back and forth. But I'll tell you one thing, if they'd examined what Ezekiel had been saying, they wouldn't know what he was talking about anyhow, would they? Well, they'd have been at a loss there to have understood much about it. But he seems to me to clothe his language here in a rather to destroy the Ammonites and destroy these people here. But now then, God's judgment is going to fall upon it when the time comes. So what does that tell us? That God uses nations to destroy nations that have reached the point they were no longer fit to exist. Then he destroyed that nation because of its cruelty and wickedness in being used. Now, so the fact that God uses a person like he used Judas, the fact that God uses a person or a nation doesn't mean that that individual is not guilty of having been used because it was in his heart to do it. Let me look at two passages, if I may, teach the same thing. Turn to Isaiah, the 10th chapter. Notice what he says here of the Assyrians. Then I want to turn to Assyria, verse 5. Isaiah 10 and verse 5. Whole Assyria, the rod of mine anger, the staff in whose hand is mine indignation. I will send him against a profane nation, and against the people of my wrath will I, nor the I there, give him a charge to take the spoil and to take the prey, and to tread them down like the mire of the streets. Howbeit he meaneth not so, neither doth his heart think so. But it is in his heart to destroy and to cut off nations, not a few. Then he goes on to tell why. Now here, he is a man in whose heart it is to do a thing. God uses him. He didn't make him that way. The man made himself that way. Then God used the Assyrians as an instrument of judgment against Judah and Israel back in 740 to 700. Now then we're down to 597 to 586 now, over 100 years later. Now he's going to use the Babylonians against Israel is already destroyed. So we're going to use him now. All right? So here then he praised up the Assyrians, but notice over here in verse 25. Now he says, for a very little while, and the indignation against thee shall be accomplished, and my anger shall be directed to his destruction. Now, when God has used Assyria as an instrument against Judah and Jerusalem and Israel, now he said, I'll set my hand to his destruction. See, well, and he said the same thing about Babylon. Babylon is my sword, but now when I've used him because of his heart, I'll destroy him. Now turn with him Habakkuk. Turn to Habakkuk, the first chapter there. Look what it says here about raising up now the Babylonians. Now here in verses 2 through 4, the prophet comes to Jehovah and asks him, why? Why do you show me so much wickedness in Jerusalem and among the people? Here's God's answer. Behold ye among the nations, and look and wonder marvelously, for I am working a work in your days which you will not believe, though it be told you. For lo, I raise up the Chaldeans, that's your Babylonians, that bitter and hasty nation that march through the breadth of the earth to possess dwelling places that are not there. They are terrible and dreadful. And he goes on to describe them here, and he comes on down and says in verse 11, then shall he sweep by as a wind, and shall pass over, and be guilty, even he whose might is his God. Then in chapter 2, he goes on to describe the character of the Babylonian, and he's going to destroy the Babylonians. But I raise up these Chaldeans. God raised them up, made them to stand to do his business, to do his work there. All right, now let me tell you one other. Go back now to Isaiah, the 45th chapter, and here he talks about Medes and the Persians here to destroy Babylon. All right, now down here in chapter 44, in verse 27 and 8, here he says here, that saith of Cyrus, he is my shepherd, and shall perform all my pleasure, even saying of Jerusalem, she shall be rebuilt. And of the temple, the foundation of the late honor. Then saith Jehovah to his anointed to Cyrus, whose right hand I have holden, to subdue nations, or loose them and all that. Comes on down here. And it comes on down, I will gird thee, in verse 5. I will gird thee, though thou hast not known thee, that they may know from the rising of the sun to the setting of it, and the west, that there are none besides me and Jehovah, that there is none else. I form the light and create darkness. I make peace and create evil. I am Jehovah that doeth these things. Now neither the Assyrian nor the Chaldean, neither the Assyrians nor the Medo-Persian, Cyrus, knew that God was using them. But God used them because it was in his heart to do these things. He used the Babylonian because of his cruelty and desire to conquer the world. What does all that say? Does that give you a little different slant on world affairs? It does me. When I read these things, I read about old Hussein over there, and World War One and Two, and then in the Korean and the other war over there, and then in this war here. God always, he's used his name, but now, this nation always has, up till now, the principles have been high. Where are they now? What are the principles by which Americans are in general are living today? Steal some salt. Don't you understand? If we're not enough salt to preserve it, God will destroy it now. When the salt is gone, then the judgment comes. But a few more years, like we've gone the last 25 or 30, and this nation will no longer fit to live.